From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, the Civil Rights Movement in the United States since World War II. That's the topic this week on Soundings, in connection with Black History Month, February 1988. My guest is Stephen Lawson of the University of South Florida. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Lawson is at work on a forthcoming book entitled From Protest to Power, Civil Rights and Black Politics Since 1945. Steve Lawson, you're at the Humanities Center from the University of South Florida. You are writing a book, a new book, on the history of American civil rights. Let me be impertinent right up front here. Another book on civil rights? Why are you doing this?
Well, I'm not writing a book that deals with civil rights in its entirety. What I'm really looking at is the relationship between the civil rights movement and the emerging growth of black politics and development of black politics since 1945. Uh-huh. We've had quite a few books, as you say, on civil rights and the civil rights movement since 1945. Most of those, I think, have been written by journalists who observed the situation at the time. A fair amount of political scientists, for instance, have mm-hmm. studied black political development, which is what I'm interested in during this particular time. We've also had historians now jumping into the field as well, doing biographies of key civil rights leaders, histories of civil rights mm-hmm. organizations. But we really have not, except maybe in one or two cases, we really have not had what I think is an overview of the civil rights movement and its impact, both positive and negative, on black politics.
Just very briefly, Steve, tell me, what is the time frame that you are working with here? Presumably after the end of the Second World
That's
War,
right.
Beginning
right.
right around then and moving into the 1980s?
Yeah, actually, the time frame ends at a moment in the future because I plan to take it through the 1988 presidential election when Jesse Jackson, I think, will have a significant impact, whether he is nominated by the Democratic Party or not.
Uh-huh. We should point out that we are taping this discussion in the fall of 1987.
Right. And he seems to be doing just fine at this particular moment.
Right.
I think black politics by necessity, what one might call black politics by necessity, has been a politics that's been designed for emancipation, for liberation.
And therefore lends itself to, not necessarily to extremism, I don't mean that,
no.
but to the exceptional, the colorful, the volatile, and the emotional, because it departs from what we associate with staid political behavior.
Yeah, because blacks have been, at least initially in this period, in the early part of this period, actually until very recently, maybe the last 10 or 15 years, blacks were fighting nonviolently for the most part to get into the political system, mm-hmm. to get into the mainstream of the political system. I mean, the groups like the NAACP, for instance, that were involved very, very strongly and very deeply in trying to get blacks the ballot, for instance. And mm-hmm. without the ballots, you obviously are not going to have much of an impact of blacks on the political system, at least the electoral political system mm-hmm. In this country. Given that concern to get into the mainstream of American politics, blacks have still, because of the resistance against their getting into the mainstream of American politics, have encountered a great deal of opposition, which led to conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Something that most Americans take for granted as an elementary right of citizenship, the right to vote, although quite a few white Americans don't use that right. Blacks did not come by without a struggle.
Yes, indeed.
And the whole thing that I think one has to understand is the dimensions of struggle that went into the acquisition of something as basic as the right to vote. And if there was as much struggle and bloodshed that went into that right, imagine how difficult it still remains to get the other quote-unquote rights.
Mm-hmm.
The changing of an economic structure and a class structure that so many of these problems involve, I think, or gender structure, don't flow very easily from the ballot box.
Uh-huh. Are we talking, Steve Lawson, only about race when we talk about political emancipation and civil rights since the end of the Second World War in the United States?
Well, the civil rights movement as an historical phenomenon really does deal with race, and it really does deal with black people. There are civil rights, obviously, that other oppressed groups fight for or share in common with blacks. But the civil rights movement as an historical phenomenon really was a movement that was geared toward the emancipation of blacks. The implications, of course, became quite clear, and groups in the 1960s, a whole host of groups, so women's liberation movement, the American Indian movement, the rights of gays and lesbians, the rights of Chicanos and farm workers in California.
There's a certain amount of exchange of political rhetoric and models in all of that.
Martin Luther King clearly was one of the leading proponents, not only of the right to vote, but also other tactics that would bring about racial equality, the tactics of nonviolent civil disobedience, which is not the same as using your ballot at the polling place. But those tactics, of course, had to be innovated, and King was particularly adept at taking other people's views and other people's strategies. He was a great synthesizer, a harmonizer, in borrowing from people like Mahatma Gandhi, from Bayard Rustin, for instance, who was particularly influential in the Montgomery bus boycott. And he was able to shape those ideas into a coherent strategy that put a great deal of pressure on the American political structure in this country to get basic rights. King thought the right to vote was very important and was one of the primary rights that would open the door, so to speak. He, in one of his earliest national addresses, one that's usually unnoticed but was quite significant in the late 1950s, at what was called a prayer pilgrimage to Washington, D.C., in commemoration of the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education. It was an anniversary of that decision. King gave a prominent address, which has become known as Give Us the Ballot, in which he says, give us the ballot and, in effect, all these other rights will come to us. We will stop being abused by the police. We will stop being abused by judges.
And that was what, hasty logic on his part?
I don't think hasty logic, really. I think there's a certain tradition within the black and white communities in this country, a certain faith in basic democratic republican with small d's and small r's values. There's a tradition of self-help in this country, intertwined with feelings of individualism and values of individualism that King himself and other black leaders, I think, imbibe, even though at the same time individualism is important. Collective action is one of the keys to the civil rights struggle.
One of the marvelous mysteries of the kind of thing that you do, cultural historians, figuring out that tension between the one and the many.
Well, you can, if I can say, you can see that because the right to vote, in a sense, comes out of a self-help tradition. The theory, again, give individuals the ballot, and then they have the key to remove their own obstacles that impede them. Now, if you did that on an individual basis, I think probably you would not have made very much progress in the South. We forget today, but the structure of race relations in the South in the period of particularly the early 1950s, and particularly after the Brown case, was quite rigid. Mississippi was known as the closed society. There were 20,000 voters in Mississippi, black voters in Mississippi, in 1954 and 55 and 56, out of which represents maybe 6% out of a total potential black vote in the South. The structure of fear, the structure of poverty, all coalesced together to make it very difficult. What you needed was organizational efforts, collective action, community support to break, I think, the tangle of fear that existed, to break the old mental patterns that of many black people in the South who accepted the notion, because they had been forced to and had been socialized to, that politics was white folks' business.
All right, now King did a lot to overcome that.
At Montgomery in particular. I think that's where Montgomery, which didn't have anything to do with the right to vote specifically,
right?
The Montgomery bus boycott. But the Montgomery bus boycott demonstrated that black people coming together, black people coming together in mass movements, applying direct action against state oppression, could liberate themselves, could emancipate themselves.
How about on the other side of the equation? Somebody who may not necessarily be a household name, if not a direct sort of causal inspiration to Martin Luther King Jr., somebody, you know, an unsung hero or heroine. Do you include people like that in your book?
Yes, I certainly hope to, and they're probably unsung to the general public. The civil rights scholars, of course, they're more familiar. Someone, for instance, who comes after King into her work in the civil rights movement is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer from Sunflower County, Mississippi.
All right, let's say that again. Fannie Lou Hamer.
Right.
From Mississippi.
That's right, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer. She was basically an uneducated sharecropper who worked on a plantation in the home county of Senator James Eastland, who was a longtime senator from Mississippi.
Why do you find her noteworthy?
Well, she represents, I think, what the civil rights struggle was all about. We know about the Martin Luther Kings. We know about the Roy Wilkins, James Farmers, and that group of prominent leaders. But we forget that black people in the South, the unsung black people in the South, were struggling before the major leaders recognized them.
They had to have something to recognize that they could lead.
That's right. They had to have a follower. Well, in many cases, these people chose the individuals like King. And King did not come up with the idea for a Montgomery bus boycott. He was chosen by a woman who led a woman's political club in Montgomery named Joanne Robinson, by a man named Ed Nixon, who was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and NAACP in Montgomery. They went to King. King was very reluctant initially to get involved in that boycott. The Fannie Lou Hamers, they dealt with people on the grassroots level day in and day out. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King did not have the time or energy to go to every community in the South and stay there for any length of time. He never would have gone very far.
So these were wonderful surrogates for him, inspirations and surrogates at the same time.
They worked with the people, and they did so day in and day out, and they were very inspiring. Mrs. Hamer, for instance, it's now probably largely forgotten, but in 1964 appeared with a group called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party from Mississippi. They went to Atlantic City, where the Democrats were having their convention, seeking to be recognized as the legitimate Democratic Party in Mississippi, because they had been barred by the regular the conventional Democratic Party in Mississippi from participation. Many of these people had not yet been able to register and vote in Mississippi, and what they were trying to do was to demonstrate to the country that the rhetoric coming out of Mississippi, that black people were happy, that black people didn't want to participate, was false. And they had formed an organization, and they had chosen delegates to the convention. And Mrs. Hamer was one of those. And she went before the Democratic Credentials Committee, and it was televised live. And she gave a most moving speech in which she recounted how a year earlier, she had been apprehended and beaten by police in a local Mississippi town for her civil rights activities. And she pleaded with the assembled delegates and the television audience that something had been done, because this couldn't be America. Could Mississippi be America if this could happen? Mm-hmm. It was so stirring and threatening to the peace of the Democratic Party, that Lyndon Johnson, who was going to be renominated anyway, but who wanted to have firm control over his political convention and not upset the Southern Democrats who were there, Lyndon Johnson called a press conference while Mrs. Hamer was speaking so that he could preempt her.
Goodness.
From the national audience. And yes, the Mrs. Hamers of the civil rights movement were powerful. They were eloquent, not because they were all that articulate or educated, but quite eloquent in the passion for which they stood for racial equality.
Steve Lawson, we're talking about your history of black political participation, civil rights in the United States since the end of the Second World War. As a historian, tell me how you figure out the mix between ideas on the one hand, personalities, events on the other. How do you tell an interesting story and stick to the facts and yet make it colorful, readable, enjoyable?
I think probably that's the goal of any writer, clearly historians. Who write narratives, who are looking to be read by a wider public and not just speak to other scholars or other social scientists.
Yeah. And I take it that you're aiming for a
wider
audience.
I'm aiming for a wider audience. What I'm really aiming for in this is perhaps to speak to college students and an informed, as we like to say, general public. You do not want to pander to entertainment. You want to tell a story, but you also want to talk about the complexities, and you want to talk about the larger social forces. And you can do that. You weave a broader tapestry. You talk about the economic and political forces that were taking place in the South, for instance, forces that most people could not see, forces of urbanization, forces of industrialization, migration practices and patterns in the South that were taking place, in effect, making that were the prerequisite for a liberation movement to occur in the South. You can talk about that. You can plant that as on the canvas of your structure.
That's quite a challenge to pull that sort of thing off. Do you worry at the same time about the deeper, perhaps more subtle problem of being accused of ideologically or politically charging your history of civil rights? It's fashionable amongst the academic conferences today to. It always amazes me. Academics are the first ones to criticize people who oversimplify in their thinking, and yet they accuse one another of being stereotypical. Well, this guy's a conservative, that woman is a liberal, here we got a Marxist, et cetera, et cetera. How do you guard yourself against that kind of problem as you write a history of civil rights? Do you worry about it at all?
I don't really worry that much about it, to tell you the truth.
I suppose that's good to hear.
the notion that there is some objective truth about the civil rights movement, I think, is misleading. First of all, there are many truths about any historical period of time, and I think it's important to have a perspective.
So you're writing this book for yourself?
No, I'm not writing it for myself, but I'm writing it through myself. I'm taking a perspective, and my perspective is a positive one in general. I mean, it's supportive. I admire the civil rights struggle. In fact, I write about the civil rights struggle because I do have a political perspective. It's almost impossible, I think,
not to
write, particularly with a lot of those of us who write about the civil rights and who write about race and who write about gender. I think you'd find this to be the case with women's historians, by and large, have moved into these areas because we do have a certain political perspective. Some even may have a political agenda. I don't know that I have a political agenda when I write this. I think if I have an agenda, it really is to open up information to people to try to move them to think about the possibilities of their own lives and their own futures. At this particular point in time, I think we have, particularly our students, the ones which I teach, feel helpless in the face of the modern world.
Surely, you have undergraduates today who wonder what happened in Vietnam, and
who take for granted, particularly in the South, and I teach in the South, who take for granted the kinds of things that are only very recent.
Yeah.
And the civil rights movement never really completed the struggle it set out to do. The civil rights movement has not achieved racial equality, at least I would argue that. I will have to be judged, as any historian, I will have to be judged by other readers, other scholars, on how I have presented my evidence. If I have not presented my evidence well, if I have left out the glaring errors of omission that would change what it is I've said, I'll
You're
be criticized
hear about it,
for
yeah.
that. So I guess my own professional ethic tempers my political perspective here. I think, if I may add, a political perspective can inform a historical or any work, really, because you coming from a certain political perspective, you ask questions that may not have been asked by someone who shares a different perspective, or even someone who says sure. he or she is neutral. Mm-hmm. The kinds of questions you ask, the topics you choose to explore, I think flows from a basic political awareness mm-hmm. that you might have.
Steve Lawson, let's conclude our conversation. You are the author of a forthcoming study of civil rights in the United States. By way of what, a general reflection or an anecdote that may come to mind, what would you leave with a general audience about the problem, the topic that you are working on? Would you talk about a personality or an event or an idea? Is there something that for you seems to crystallize things briefly?
Well, there are many, many anecdotes, really, because there have been many high points in the civil rights struggle. There have been some low points as well in the civil rights struggle. I think the struggle has been a movement of individuals, and I think if we remember that, I think we're a lot better off. If we wait around for leaders to come, I think it can be a long time until another Martin Luther King, for instance, comes around. I think it's important to remember that ordinary people were involved in the struggle to gain racial equality in this country. It was ordinary people who gathered in the churches of Montgomery, or the churches of Albany, or the churches in Selma, to provide the foot soldiers, as King would have called them, mm-hmm. of the civil rights movement. And their stories are countless. And what's amazing, I think, about their stories, and to me, what is most impressive, if one thinks about it, is this notion of transformation of people. People have transformed themselves in effect from a bondage, from an oppression, to a potential, if not actual, a liberation in this country, and particularly in the South. They've also transformed the South. The South is not the same place as it was 40 years ago, or even 20 years ago. I'm reminded, and again, these are just unsung people, but I'm reminded of a woman, a middle-aged woman who had never been able to vote in her life, in her own lifetime. In 1965, as a result of the Voting Rights Act, the federal government sent down registrars into the South to sign up black people for voting, and they sent them to counties in particular that had been most resistant to racial equality. And this was a middle-aged woman. Her name is Ardies Malden. I certainly never met her, and I just read about her in account. And she stood online all morning waiting for the polling booth to open, and standing on the sideline. This was in Selma, Alabama, which had been one of the precipitants for the Voting Rights Act of that year.
So this would have been what, mid-60s?
1965. Uh-huh. This would have been August of 1965, after the Voting Rights Act was passed, and that previous months had seen the very, seen demonstrations in Selma, which had left two or three people killed, a great deal of blood shed. And the sheriff of the county in which Selma is in, Dallas County, a man by the name of Jim Clark, who had had used his baton and his police weapons to keep cattle prods to keep blacks from voting and demonstrating. He was watching along the sidelines, pacing up and down. And Clark was the kind of menacing sheriff that most blacks had to face as a reality of their lives. But now something new had happened. Now, in effect, the Mrs. Maldens of the South had the federal government on their side, and they had legitimacy on their side. They had the backing, not only of moral authority, but legal authority on her side. And she just stood in line and was not terribly impressed with Sheriff Clark. And finally she voted, and she didn't vote, she registered and signed up to vote. And someone asked her afterward, and she said, well, it didn't take a few minutes. She said, I don't know why it couldn't be that easy in the first place. She left. And interesting, within the year, Sheriff Clark, who was running for a different office, was defeated as a result of black votes. And that would become a sort of a common pattern in the South. I think ultimately it's important to remember, and this book can go on forever, I suppose. I'll stop in 1988, but it could go on forever, because the struggle, that phase of the struggle has ended. The acquisition of legal power, if you will, has probably come as far as it can. The next step is the acquisition of a certain amount of economic power, the kinds of things.
We've been hearing about that for quite a while now. Why are black citizens not fully enfranchised, what, economically and culturally as well as politically?
There, I think it's also a question of, it's of course a class issue. Mm-hmm. As well, blacks are not.
And race becomes, it's important, it's there, but it isn't as primary as it has been.
Well, there's a debate about that. Uh-huh. There are some who see the what they call the declining significance of race as a factor there. There has grown since the 1960s, a black middle class. It's always been a black middle class, but there's grown a much larger black middle class, and even the occupations within it have improved, more professional status than ever before. And I think that's why some don't see it as a race issue, because blacks have moved into the middle class to a great extent, but mm-hmm. But they've left behind still is a very large portion of blacks in the lower class, and there are of course whites in that group too. And the argument is that it's really not race any longer. We don't have the laws that say you can't drink out of the same water fountains and so forth. That it's got to be a function of the fact these are poor people, and they're poor people not because they're black, but they're poor people because the economy somehow is structured in a way that deprives them of the opportunity to move up the economic ladder. They have poor education, they have poor housing, and so mm-hmm. forth. But I think, given the history of this country, I don't think you can separate that easily problems of race from problems of class. I think for black people particularly, race and class have joined together in many instances. And now to separate them is not quite so easy. And even those blacks in the middle class are probably more vulnerable to falling out of the middle class, I think, than even white Americans at this point.
Steve, good luck with your book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Stephen Lawson teaches at the University of South Florida. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Lawson is at work on a forthcoming book entitled From Protest to Power, Civil Rights and Black Politics Since 1945. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on the Civil Rights Movement in America since World War II is available on cassette. Ask for program number 386. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. That's program number 386. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Christopher Stone of the University of Southern California Law Center will discuss his new book, Earth and Other Ethics. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Civil Rights and Black Politics in America since 1945. This week on Soundings. Listen for Stephen Lawson, a professor of history from the University of South Florida. From Protest to Power, Civil Rights and Black Politics Since 1945. This week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.